Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Today on the pod, will the federal government's new rental bill of rights have any impact in the middle of a housing crunch? Plus, under new rules in Ontario, most international student spaces will be allocated to public institutions with no spaces for private career colleges. Is it time BC do the same? And we'll continue our coverage of the $4 billion North Shore wastewater treatment plant boondoggle. And as more movies vanish from streaming services, cinephiles are rallying to physical media. Can they save a dying format? That's all next on the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast.
Let's get to our top story. Politicians and other officials are voicing their displeasure after Metro Vancouver announced the budget for the troubled North Shore wastewater plant project has grown to $3.8 billion. The plant was initially scheduled for completion by December of 2020 at a cost of $500 million. Now, Metro Vancouver fired the original contractor, Axiona Wastewater Solutions, in October of 2021. At which point the project's estimated cost had increased to more than $1 billion. The two parties remain in a legal battle over the project in BC Supreme Court, where each side has filed a lawsuit against the other. And I know you've heard this before, but I do want to reiterate this. According to Metro Vancouver, the new price tag means households within the North Shore sewage area will be on the hook for an average tax increase of $725 annually for the next 30 years. The average cost does not compound over those 30 years, and the rest of the Lower Mainland will be hit for about a $70 to $140 increase per year for the next 15 years. Now, a new Westminster City Councillor is calling for a public inquiry after the regional district admitted the still-to-be-completed wastewater treatment plant in North Vancouver has been a budget blowout. Joining me now to discuss the issue is new Westminster City Councillor Daniel Fontaine. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jess.
Good to have you. First and foremost, were you aware that the number was going to be this high? I know the story broke many months ago, but it's been forgotten, hasn't it? I mean, were you a bit shocked when you heard the numbers?
I think shocked is an understatement. There was recently something called the Council of Councils, which is a council of all the councillors and mayors that it had a meeting in early February, February 3rd. Mm-hmm. And I went back to look at the agenda at that meeting just to see, I wasn't able to attend, but just to see whether or not the topic of the wastewater treatment plant was there. And there was absolutely nothing on the agenda to raise any concern at that particular meeting. So when I look at something that's gone from $500 million to almost $4 billion in cost, clearly we have a problem here. And it is, in my opinion, it's structural. It requires a public inquiry, a forensic audit. And furthermore, I'm calling on an actual governance review of the entire Metro Vancouver board and the way that we elect and the way that we govern ourselves in this region. Because I think if nothing else, I'm hoping coming out of this that we have a very different way to manage our Metro Vancouver.
Do you know if the elected officials that were there when the initial decisions were made, when there should have been oversight, not only just from the elected officials, but from public servants that we paid, any sense of who, if any, is still around?
I'm told they're all gone. I'm told that basically all the people that were there at the senior levels from the public service side, as well as the vast majority of the elected officials who were there provide oversight, are all gone, which kind of begs the question, you know, with this type of churn and this type of staff turnover over the coming years, did that potentially play into this? And did it play into the fact that we've gone from $500 million to $4 billion? But those are the kind of questions I think that I'm hoping the BC Auditor General or somebody to that equivalent can dig into and find out what went wrong with this project. Because by my estimation, Jazz, and we've had a lot of mega projects go into the ditch in this province, I think as a percentage in terms of the cost overruns, this likely is the most costliest overrun of any mega project in the province of British Columbia. And I'm comparing that to Fast Ferries and Site C and a lot of other projects. So I think this should merit some extra attention.
Yeah, in dollar terms, Site C would be more from $8 billion to $16 billion. And we talked about that yesterday with the ferry CEO who was on the show. But that's 100% increase. This went from $700 million, as you say, to nearly $4 billion. And that's an even bigger increase when you look at the hard numbers. I'm curious, broadly speaking, is there such thing as an auditor general at the regional level, much like you would have for the provincial or federal governments, where you know they're independent, they can ask whatever questions they want, they can demand answers, and they put out a report every year, we report on it, Is there something at the regional level that has that somebody that has the same responsibility?
Well, sadly, Jazz, in 2017, when the NDP government took over, that was one of the first things that they eliminated was actually a municipal auditor general. It was something that I really supported. I thought was a very important move, and I applauded the previous provincial government for bringing it forward. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there were a number of issues with the municipal auditor general. They weren't doing enough fast enough, and I think at the end of the day, the NDP government just didn't feel there was any value there. But there is no regional auditor general, and there definitely is no longer a provincial auditor general. But if we ever saw a project where we needed someone who's independent with a number of bean counters who can go in and take a look at it, it's this project. And right now I'm defaulting to the BC auditor general because there's nowhere else that we can turn other than that particular body.
So would the auditor general provincially have to be asked to do this, or can they request?
No, I believe they would have to be asked. This is a fully kind of under the municipal Metro Vancouver control. But here's the trigger for me is, the province has actually contributed $200 million towards this project. So it's not like the province isn't involved. It's not like the provincial dollars aren't involved. So for me, if there's a hook to get the BC Auditor General involved in this particular review, that's it. And remember, the federal government have also contributed $200 million. So they too should have an interest in what happened with this project. So I'm hoping the Premier will listen to that call and bring the Auditor General in and provide the public with a bit of certainty.
Now, one of the things you and I talking about just off air for a moment is just regional government, and that, you know, if something happens in your municipality, let's say in New Westminster, you have a mayor who is accountable, that the media can ask questions of, citizens can demand answers of, city councillors, or an opposition that can ask questions, whatever it may be, provincial, federal, same sort of thing. But this regional government, there was a public servant who held a press conference, let us know what happened. And it happened in the midst of spring break on a Friday afternoon.
Take out the trash Friday.
Take out the trash Friday. That says a lot, doesn't it? So the question really is, why are they not as accountable at the regional level? And I want to play a little clip for you. Kirk Lapointe, who's a columnist for the Glacier Media, who was on the show yesterday, he originally broke this story many months ago, last year, and then things, of course, went quiet until Metro Vancouver finally came in and said, yes, that is the real number, the $3.8 billion. But Kirk and I have been talking about this. He was on the show then, and we talked about it just the other day as well. Here's his take on the overrun and what is the core issue.
What we really got here is a systemic problem, and I think it's a larger problem than just individuals coming and going in the service of Metro Vancouver. It's whether we, in fact, need an entirely different approach to it with a different level of government that would take duties away from municipalities and have them conferred by the province in such a way that you get a very different echelon of leader with full-time focus at a regional level.
Now, this would be, I guess they do this in Toronto, and no system is ever perfect. And I know the college will say, well, I don't need another layer of politicians. Well, you already got it, one would argue. And what do you think of what Kirk is saying?
Well, you absolutely have another layer, except this layer is unelected. It's unaccountable and it's not open and transparent. These are all elected officials who get elected at local municipal councils. In the case of New Westminster, like myself, our mayor appoints himself effectively to the Metro Vancouver board, and that's it. He goes off to Metro Vancouver and they govern themselves. There's no accountability there. Jazz, that news conference, to me, if there is nothing else that proves the point that we need to have a review of the governance of Metro Vancouver, it's the fact that there wasn't a single elected official within a nuclear blast zone of that news conference. That news conference should have had at least one, if not more, elected officials there to be able to respond to media questions. And again, further, why was this done on a Friday afternoon? Before a spring break, what did they think? That the public and you and I would not be able to see that the North Shore residents were going to be paying $725 a year for the next 30 years? So there's something broken. As Kirk said, I think that's why I think it's important for the governance review. I'm hoping we're in a provincial election, Jazz. I'm hoping that, you know, the Kevin Falcon, the BC United, David Eby, NDP, others, the Greens, they look at this and say, we have an opportunity to maybe put this in our campaign platform, that we will commit to at least conducting a review and getting those recommendations made public. And hopefully we can incorporate some of that into the 2026 municipal election.
We're speaking to Daniel Fontaine, New Westminster City Councillor. He is asking for a full public inquiry after the regional government The Metro Vancouver Regional Government admitted that the still-to-be-completed wastewater treatment plant in North Vancouver is incredibly over budget. $700 million was the original estimate. Now, of course, nearly $4 billion. And the folks in the North Shore will be paying, if this goes ahead, an average tax increase of $725 yearly for the next 30 years, $70 to $140 for the rest of the residents in the Lower Mainland for the next 15 years. And that doesn't. And we haven't gotten to this, Daniel, yet. The Iona treatment plant, which is based in Richmond, but basically handles the same sort of thing the North Shore treatment plant would do for the residents of Vancouver, University Endowment Lands, UBC, and partially Burnaby. And that price tag in today's dollars, folks, is $10.4 billion over the next 15 years. So you can imagine what it would be if it was if we were looking at this North Shore budget, that's for sure. But let's go to open lines. I want to hear from you, 604-280-9898, *9898 on your cell phone. What do you think needs to happen here in regards to this particular issue in the North Shore? Let's go to Ed in Victoria. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Jeff. If there's not a continuity in representation of something that's got the ability to pass a budget, it's crazy. You've got to be able to ask questions. Why did you pick this contractor? Who decided that? And beyond that, the money increased four times. How is it not a fixed contract based on the fact that it's taxpayer money? And the idea that some people can be appointed to a board, what level of competency do they have to make these decisions?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ed, thank you for your call. I mean, he does raise a good issue. I mean, you do want to have a wide range of citizens running for office, right? And I've said this before, it just can't be everybody who's a lawyer, an accountant, or an engineer should run for office. I think there's wisdom in everyday people as well. But when you do that, you have a really strong group of public servants who are going to be there depending on – doesn't matter what party or an individual is elected, right, Daniel?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
sure.
What I don't understand is that's generally how the system works. What broke down?
Well, that's the $4 billion question, Jazz. And that's one of the reasons why until we go under the hood and take a look and actually ask those questions and get those answers, we won't be able to answer that. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is here is this is now in the courts. So as a result of it being in the courts, nobody at Metro Vancouver, none of the elected officials are talking. I heard you had Mayor Harvey on here last week. His answers were very opaque and kind of vague, and he kept saying, you know, I can't talk, this is before the courts. So we're not getting any answers, yet we are all getting the bills for $4 billion. So your caller raises a really good point. There, I have a litany of questions, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that has a litany of questions as to how we got to this point. But the only way we're going to be able to do that is, to me, through a public inquiry where people be forced to testify, documents will be brought forward, former staff who worked at Metro Vancouver and other individuals will be called in to actually provide some guidance as to what went wrong. Without that, we're going to be speculating about this up until the next mega project goes over budget again.
That's for sure. Let's go to Chris in Penticton. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I love your program. You know, we'll cut them some slack. Say it went double, okay? So $1.4 billion, okay? So that means even if they doubled it, they should have still been able to build almost three plants. It just boggles my mind. There has to be an audit, a forensic audit. There has to be account happening here. Because as a taxpayer, my heavens, you just can't do this to the citizens of this province and of the Lower Mainland as well. I mean, it's just absolutely disgusting.
Chris, I got to ask you a question. Would you be open to having elections for regional leaders?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that should be done. Because then there's accountability. There's no accountability if you're being appointed. You start seeing things go wrong, I'm just going to step away and not be accountable for it. Absolutely, they should be elected.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Danny, let me ask you this question. Maybe that's the deeper question here, and Kirk raised it as well in regards to structural challenges. Should we be talking about electing regional leaders, number one? And is that also part and parcel of a deeper conversation? Is maybe we need to amalgamate, maybe not one city. What I've always said is 4 to 8 municipalities. I mean, should we actually be having that conversation? I know it's got nothing to do with the cost today for the North Shore, but it speaks to governance of the region of 3 million people. We hit 3 million, I think, in July this year.
Yep.
Another million coming after that. We can't just have 21 municipalities sort of building this place. I'm not sure if it works over the long term. Is that perhaps a conversation we also need to be having?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I was calling for a governance review. I brought a motion forward to New West Council. It got unanimously supported, and it's been sent up to Metro Vancouver for review. But I think that the governance review would touch on that, Jazz. I don't want to kind of prejudge what a governance review would actually come back with. There might be some other solutions or other things that come forward. So I think, you know, I've even for myself, I've vacillated back and forth on electing directly Metro. I'm worried about creating a whole other layer of government. But when I see these types of projects and I see the lack of oversight and accountability that your caller mentioned, I can't help but think to myself that at least if you had someone who was directly elected, they would, like myself in New West, I'm accountable to the voters in New Westminster. They can see me at the store. They know where I am in the local community. There's just not that connection there. So I think that a governance review wouldn't take very long. I think we could involve the public, get some feedback, like your listeners, to weigh in, and then put that on the ballot in 2026. And let's ask the public whether or not they support it. And if they don't, we'll stick with the same system we have for years to come.
Daniel, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Vancouver. I never in my wildest dreams thought I'd leave you and move to Edmonton, but I had this great job opportunity, so I came here in 2019. And so far, I've been pleasantly surprised. The people here are friendly and helpful. The food scene is amazing. There's plenty of stuff to do. And I bought my first house for just over $400,000, which is kind of like a cherry on top.
Alberta is calling.
Alberta was calling. That's an ad that was running right here on CKNW. In fact, we had Alberta Premier, then Alberta Premier Jason Kenney on our show talking about their campaign, Alberta Calling. And it has been very successful based on new numbers that come out of Stats Canada. Joining me now is show contributor Jerry Mayer Judson and former Calgary resident as well.
That's right. 25 years in Alberta.
Well, we at least have convinced you to come. So, but the numbers don't look that good at this point in regards to British Columbians heading.
No. So we have something like 37,000 British Columbians in 2023 moved to Alberta, which compares to 22,000 Albertans moving to BC. So in BC, you know, we saw negative net migration for the first interprovincial migration for the first time since, I think, 2012.
Wow.
That we lost, you know, 8,000 people. So truly, I think people are getting scared away. Now, I'm a lapsed Albertan. I moved out here in 2020, and I was curious to look at the interprovincial migration numbers from the year that I moved here. And so in 2020, about 25,000 Albertans moved to British Columbia. So more Albertans technically were coming than 2023. But in terms of British Columbians moving to Alberta, 16,000. So
that
people
year.
That year in 2020. So I was really... Like, that's staggering. And then this year, right? 37,000.
Moved to Alberta. And so Alberta, let's say 55,000, that's the largest net gain in interprovincial migration for 2023, but the largest gain in interprovincial migration since data was first kept since 1972.
Like, since we started counting.
So the oil and gas is booming. And as whoever that guy was who left Vancouver but bought a house for $400,000,
that's
apparently.
Like, hello.
So, I mean, here's my question to you. Why did you move here? Was it career opportunity? Did you know how expensive this place was? Why did you want to come here?
Honestly, myself and my partner were kind of stagnant in Calgary. We both had degrees from the University of Calgary, but we weren't really doing anything with those degrees. So we actually moved out here for school. For media arts school.
Okay.
So various things that there's just more industry for that in Vancouver. So, and this just happened to be where I found my career. This happened to be where my job is. So, and you know, I'm not going to sit here and lie. I'm not going to say I haven't looked over the Rockies a little fondly, especially learning about you can get a house for, you know, just under $400,000. Still, right? Or maybe not still, because that's from, you know.
It is getting more expensive, what I've heard, in regards to rentals and everything else.
And it's the Wild West with rental legislation or lack thereof. There's a lot of people that are getting kind of just, their landlord will say, well, you know what? I can actually charge you $1,000 more, or someone else from British Columbia will come and be happy to pay it.
But the idea of getting into a house for, let's say, $500,000.
Oh, could you imagine it, Jazz?
I know. It's, well, one of the joys of not being surrounded by mountains, water, ALR, all border, all those types of things, right? There's an advantage there. Do you think this is going to continue in your mind?
Totally. I think so. It has to until Calgary becomes like the new Vancouver and people get priced out and move to, I guess, Moose Jaw or something.
There's no like Calgary can just keep growing, right?
And it does. It grows laterally like the blob. Also, I take issue with that. No offense, Edmonton. The shopping is really good in Edmonton. I don't know about the eating, though.
Okay.
I don't know. Vancouver. I'll miss the food if I go.
But it is sprawl, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Not that Vancouver isn't sprawl,
huge.
But we do density better, right?
Yes. I think the 21 municipality thing is just so silly a little bit. It's funny to me because in Calgary, this would all just be Calgary. This would just be suburbs of Calgary. This would just be neighborhoods. Yeah. But then you have these 21 distinct cities with their 21 distinct identities. And it's so
interesting. And then we got a regional board that wants to spend $4
billion
for $7 million. Yeah, so.
Whoopsies.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we have different kinds of boondoggles in Alberta, but this over governance and these different boards to kind of bring together these 21 different municipalities, at least in the major Albertan cities, you don't have that because we just decided this geographical location is a city now.
Well, I always find it interesting. You're doing great when oil and gas is doing great.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Very subjective
and,
well-being.
And then you can brag about not having PST. When oil and gas isn't doing great, then you could probably use some of that PST
Everyone's
revenue.
Everyone's running around like scared rodents. Like, what are we? Oh, but speaking of rodents, rat-free. So if you really hate rats, go to Alberta. Alberta is calling if you get freaked out by rats, Jazz.
That is true. Yeah, I remember when I worked for the energy industry, I mean, when prices go down, downtown Calgary is a ghost
vacant
town.
Like you see bits of paper blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
There's tumbleweeds. It's really scary. It really is kind of, it feels not gold rushy exactly because it's a little more reliable than that, but truly it's the main economic pillar is very volatile. So that was an interesting environment to grow up in.
When I speak to young people today, look, I came from a small town in the interior. I've been incredibly fortunate, worked very hard, but fortunate as well. I don't ever pretend to think that, you know, we all do it just by pulling up our bootstraps. There's luck involved. It's life. But, you know, if someone tells me, what would you tell young people today? I said, you know, you can have the best degree. You can work really hard with a bit of luck, perhaps parents helping you. You can get into a home. You know, it's not going to be perhaps a single family home, but it's going to be a condominium or whatever it may be. But you're just going to get that much further in regards to quality of life in Calgary. Okay, you have winters, real winters compared to
get a jacket.
Yeah, get a jacket. But I mean, this is the part that annoys me is that if you play by the rules, it's easier in Alberta.
Most definitely. That's kind of where I felt like I was getting sold a bill of goods, and that's where I felt like I can maybe reasonably successful. And I kind of knew the opportunity cost of moving to Vancouver, but it just happens to be where a lot of industries do exist that industries don't necessarily exist in Alberta. They're trying, bless them, to get more arts, more film, more things like this. With The Last of Us, that was a big get for Alberta. So they're trying, but
here's the thing. I'll tell you, when I had Jason Kenney on, one of the things we talked about was food security. It sort of came out of left field, but it was talking about vertical farming and growing inside, like they do in the Netherlands, where you can have three crops of, let's say, blueberries rather than one crop outdoors here in Vancouver, which is very expensive ALR land too. And the amount of people that I've talked to is saying there's so many of these new food companies that want to grow indoors. They've got the warehouse space, which means they have all that commercial space that's required, the industrial space that's required, which we're struggling with here.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually opening up new industries like that, like, you know, to deal with food security and all those types of things. It's harder to get moving on the legislative side to get something like that moving forward. Jason Kenney, when I asked him that, I came out of left field when I asked him that question. He got so excited about, you know, we got these warehouses opening up and we're going to be doing vertical farming and they're doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should not take anything for granted in this city that somehow everybody wants to move here. It's a bit of a myth, in my opinion.
Especially in 2024, man.
Yeah, people like it here, but, you know, you still want to get ahead. You still want to have a home. You still want to have some money left over. As I always like to say, take the kids to Disneyland once a year, whatever it may be. And that's the challenge. And when you're charging people to pay $700 more for a wastewater treatment plant or whatever it may be, it is getting ridiculous. People cannot get ahead. So it should be a wake-up call for our NDP government. I don't care if you don't like Daniel Smith's politics. They're doing something right over there because when people vote with their feet, it's loud and clear, and you better darn well pay attention. That's my rant. I'll be quiet now.
I love it.
But I want to hear from all of you out there. Give me a call on the buzz line. Some would argue we saw this in the 1990s when the NDP were in power. Different type of party, but still, there's something that's very similar here, folks. More people moving to Alberta. Call me on the buzz line. I want to hear from you on this issue. 604-331-2899. That's 604-331-2899. Or email me, jazz@cknw.com. Jerry, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
The federal government says they'll create a new Canadian Renters Bill of Rights, which would require landlords to disclose their property's rental price history to prospective tenants. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in Vancouver yesterday where he made the announcement. Take a listen.
We're announcing new protections for renters and new pathways to home ownership. As part of our upcoming budget, we're going to create a Canadian Renters Bill of Rights. It would create a nationwide standard for lease agreements, give renters a clear history of apartment pricing so they can bargain fairly, and make sure they have more agency. We're also going to launch a new legal aid fund that will protect tenants against unfairly rising rents, rent evictions, and bad landlords.
That was Prime Minister Justin Trudeau yesterday. Joining me now to talk a little bit about the new Renters Bill of Rights is David Hutniak, CEO of Landlord BC. David, thank you for joining us.
Hey, hi, Jazz.
What do you make of this announcement yesterday from Prime Minister Trudeau?
You know, I'll answer the question this way. You know, they actually have done some really good stuff in terms of pushing out hundreds of millions of dollars for affordable housing across Canada. You know, Sean Fraser has been out there cajoling municipalities and provinces, so they deserve a lot of credit for that. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, you know, the great announcement here in terms of significantly tightening up non-permanent residents entering Canada. Those two things, you know, are going to have a real meaningful impact in terms of the whole rental housing crisis, looking at supply, which is the real issue. The announcement yesterday was, you know, in that context, was kind of not earth-shattering, I guess is the best way to describe it. And I think I'm hearing other stakeholders say similarly, that it was not anything particularly exciting. I don't know the Canadian Renters Bill of Rights, you know, really don't have a lot of detail around it. I can say that, you know, they're going to have to negotiate this with the provinces and territories. I cannot see any province agreeing to a national standardized lease agreement because every province has different tenancy regulations. And, you know, in terms of the disclosure of price history for the unit, you know, we live in a time here where more disclosure is a reality. This is something that, you know, we talked to our members about the fact that increased transparency is just is important and increasingly more important. I don't, you know, see any particular issues with this if it's going to be the information of some value to tenants. That's great. If anything, what it'll do is actually help us, you know, build our business case to say that, you know, in these rent-controlled units, you can now see the tenant who lived there for 10 years is paying, you know, $500 a month. And in that time, our expenses have gone through the roof and our rents have been capped. So, I mean, I'm not sure that where this is all going. So, you know, a lot of detail is still missing around that piece of it.
So let's do the history issue first in regards to the rental registry, the history for a moment. You're telling me this won't impact the ability for tenants to perhaps demand perhaps lower rent or be in a better position to bargain? What if a tenant were to say, look, you've raised you've increased the rent every single year over the last 10 years. I know in this case you haven't been able to for a few years with COVID, but if they were to say, look, you've been raising rent every year by a certain amount, could you not at least negotiate? Would that not help you in regards to having that information to push back a little bit in regards to negotiating with landlords?
Well, I guess in theory, this measure would allow for that. I don't know that it's necessarily, you know, a huge concern. Certainly, you know, the market ultimately determines the price. And you know, if the particular landlord is perhaps not acutely aware of what the market rent is for a similar unit, I suppose that this process, by having this disclosure, would facilitate that sort of a conversation with prospective renters. At the end of the day, you know, that's not necessarily unhealthy. And furthermore, you know, when you look at the demand versus the supply, you know, I don't know that those opportunities are going to, you know, exist in huge numbers necessarily. The fact is, you know, unfortunately, currently, it's still very difficult to find rental housing. So, you know, we don't see this as some big threat to our industry. And this is data that, you know, the transparency by providing this data, we don't think is necessarily unhealthy.
The standardized leasing agreement, mm-hmm. you feel that there's just no way it's going to get done with so many jurisdictions, different perspectives, different views on landlords and tenants. You just the federal government just won't be able to do that?
Well, I'll be shocked, put it that way. Certainly, you know, as an association, we do not support that concept, and I really just cannot see any of the provinces agreeing to it either. No,
is this window dressing in your mind? All of this is just a sort of political performance art before an election, probably next year, of course.
Well, Chaz, you're asking me to be cynical. Come on, man.
I am. I mean,
You know, here's the thing. Again, as I opened my comments there, I'm saying they actually have announced some really good things, mm-hmm. you know, the big ticket items, and this is less so. But by the same token, listen, we're totally fine with the tenant protection fund. You know, we don't begrudge the government deciding to provide that additional support. So that's not a bad thing. The credit history issue that they've identified, you know, we've been, you know, advancing the need for rent payment history for basically screening of tenants for years. In fact, some landlords have access to that through service providers who basically, with the consent of renters, have, you know, built some credit rent payment history. But this would actually be a really good thing, you know, if it were more broadly accepted. So, I mean, those two elements of the announcement, I think, have some interesting potential. The Renter's Bill of Rights, I mean, the other thing is, I mean, renters in Canada and in British Columbia, I would say in particular, you know, have really strong rights through the Residential Tenancy Act. They have human rights protection. They have privacy protections. I mean, we're just really not sure ultimately where they're going with this whole initiative, and what they've announced initially in the context of that Bill of Rights. You know, the standardized tenancy agreement and you know, the disclosure of historical rents for a unit. Yeah, I mean, I guess those are not earth-shattering announcements.
David, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Yesterday, in a press release, quite quietly, the government of Ontario announced that its study permit allocation will focus on prioritizing post-secondary educational programs at public universities and colleges to help prepare graduates for in-demand jobs. What's that really mean? Well, basically says that international study permits, those are the ones that allow international students to come in and go to school here, 96% of those study permits will go to public universities and colleges in Ontario, while the remainder will be split between language schools, private universities, and other institutions across the province. This allocation generally means that career colleges will be excluded from receiving any international student permit applications, and career colleges are generally viewed as private universities and colleges. You see a lot of them here in downtown Vancouver. You also see a lot of them in the suburbs as well, whether they're teaching you accounting programs or how to be a truck driver, all those types of programs. So it's quite interesting that 96% of those study permits are now going to be geared towards public universities and colleges, and only 4% for what is often referred to as private institutions or career colleges. Joining now to talk a little bit about this issue and whether or not BC should be doing the same thing is Barj Dahan. He's co-founder and director of the Canada-India Education Society. Barj, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Your thoughts on what Ontario announced yesterday?
This is unexpected because I think about a month ago they were saying that the allocation towards the publicly funded university and college would be about 35%. So this is a very dramatic move. Basically, 96% of the study permits will be going to the publicly funded universities and colleges. Very dramatic, unlike British Columbia, where in British Columbia, our government has said 53% of the study permits would be allocated to the publicly funded universities and colleges, and 47% going to the private.
So you think this, in what Ontario is doing, is a positive?
I think it's a positive, but it's probably not what most people were expecting in this whole industry. But I think that's a very powerful statement because their minister, Jill Dunlop, she said that they were doing this to protect the integrity of Ontario's post-secondary education. And that's the thing that I've been arguing about for the last 2 years, that the way our governments have been handling international student permits, it's really undermining Canada's post-secondary education, which is largely publicly funded.
So let me just talk about Ontario just for a second before I get back to BC. When, you know, 96% of all future study permits will go to public institutions, so universities and public colleges. You're basically saying we don't mind those private colleges that have sprouted up everywhere in Ontario. It's the number one place for international students. There's most likely these schools are either going to have to downsize significantly or some of them will probably just go bankrupt.
Oh, absolutely. There are lots of them that are going to close up. They will have to close up. The reality is, you know, when you look back about 18 years ago when these private institutions started cropping up across the country, the idea was that they would basically augment our publicly funded system. So Canadians who want to get career-oriented training, they could do it in these private colleges. But then as international education was really pushed by both the federal government and the provincial governments, these private institutions were able to recruit international students from overseas.
I mean, these are diploma mills, right? I mean, I'm not going to say all of them, but if you're paying $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 for a program, I view these as nothing more than diploma mills.
That's what they were. And I think we have many cases here in Metro Vancouver, maybe more so in Ontario. And some of these puppy mill schools, they're basically a hole in the wall in some industrial space. There's not even a classroom.
So in British Columbia, so what you're saying here, 53% of the study permits go to public institutions, 47 still go to private. We should actually be looking at the Ontario model then?
I think we need to be looking at increasing the international study permits to the publicly funded institutions. It should be, a number should be more, maybe, you know, 75-80% range. You know, that's just my view.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is, you know, whether one agrees with it or not, the reality is the situation we find ourselves across the country in this has been in the making for 18 years, largely promoted by both the federal government and provincial governments. So in Ontario, for example, in 2019, they froze tuition fees and then really pushed the institutions to recruit overseas. Now they're realizing, gee, there's unintended consequences. We better deal with this. So in British Columbia, I think the move, the decision by our Ministry of Education here saying 53% of international study permits will go to universities and colleges, it appears to be more a balanced kind of approach, but I think long-term, we need to change those numbers. We need to reduce the international student permits going to these puppy mill schools. And here's why.
Hmm.
Because those private colleges, when somebody, a student, completes the program, they will not receive a postgraduate work permit. So then those graduates want to stay here. Then that's where I think the abuse, the misuse, the fraud kicks in, because all of those want to work and they want to stay in the country, become permanent residents, and that's where the abuse is. So that abuse also has to end.
So is this a, I mean, at the end of the day, who would you blame here? You said this has been going on for 18 years, but it seems like we somehow, the system's been just on steroids in regards to international students being allowed to come into Canada over the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, a lot of this is still Mr. Trudeau and his federal Liberal government that have really, you know, moved it to the point where this story is now front page news across this country. It seems like we really got it wrong in and around COVID.
Well, I think what we experienced today was going to happen anyways, because the push from the early 2000s in Ontario and British Columbia was privatize our post-secondary education. And now we have this rude awakening that it's not working. Our stellar global reputation around our, you know, post-secondary education system has been tarnished. It's under risk. So the reality in British Columbia is, if the province is saying 47% of international study permits will still go to private colleges, then there's an admission that 47% of international students are in these private institutions.
Hmm. Barge, as always, thank you so much for your time on this issue.
Thank you, Jess.
Roll sound.
Rolling.
Screen time.
It's Screen Time, where we discuss movies, television, arts, and culture and give you a sprinkle of industry insights. Let's dive into the world of glitz, glamour, and all things Hollywood. Here's a question for you. How many times have you complained about how much you're paying for streaming services? All those streaming service hikes are starting to add up. On average, streaming households now spend $82 per month for 4 subscriptions to different streaming services, according to a new survey by Deloitte. And that same survey found monthly costs is up 27% from $65 a year earlier. Now, streaming was supposed to kill physical media and has come very close. The DVD and Blu-ray market fell from $4.7 billion in revenue in 2017 to barely $1.5 billion in 2022. Last September, Netflix also ended its movie-by-mail service. Best Buy has also removed physical media from its bricks-and-mortar stores, and some new films may never be released physically at all. Physical media will never regain its heights, but it may live to fight a little longer. In many ways, a counter-revolution has been gathering. Some film fans never gave up physical media. They've spent years quietly buying thrift store discs, while others have recently rediscovered physical media. Joining me now is one man who remains a huge fan of DVDs. Mark Staling is CKNW's in-house movie expert and an executive producer for AM 730. Mark, good to see you again.
Good to be with you, as always, Jazz.
So, why do you still have a DVD collection?
Oh, boy. Well, it's in my blood a little bit. I've always been a collector. My dad was a collector of LPs and then CDs, and I grew up with a library of VHS and beta tapes, you know, as a child of the 80s and the 90s. But now, you know, as a film buff, as a cinephile or whatever you want to call it, in order to see the movies I want to see, I need to have them at my fingertips. There's no guarantee that I can stream them or I can see them via other means. That's certainly part of it. There's something just physical and tactile and nice about having things on your shelf and having your little library that you can go and peruse and curate your own collection of movies from, you know, we're looking at 100 years of movies we're dealing with here.
So how many movies do you have, physical copies?
Just over 1,500.
No way.
Yeah.
1,500?
So, and we're looking in the range of over 1,000 Blu-rays, still pushing 500 DVDs that I haven't upgraded to the HD version yet. Although I've taken this next step, this new plunge into the 4K world, which is the latest and greatest technology, which I think might be the end of the road. I don't know how many more, you know, pixels they can get involved. But I recently got a 4K player at Christmas. I've got about 20 titles there. And I'm telling myself I'm only going to upgrade those real movies that I just love, 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 those 5-star titles to that new format. I can't go and upgrade every single title that I've got. It's a slippery slope. You want to have the best version available, but yeah.
What's a 4K DVD cost?
They're more. Oppenheimer, which was the big one, the big seller. I think the MSRP on that's $34.99 or maybe even $39.99. There, it's the days of 2 DVDs for $10 at the local future shop or Best Buy or whatever. Those are a thing of the past. The 4K discs cost a lot more to produce. It's a smaller niche market, so you're in the range of $30 to $40. Sales are key, so I'm definitely always monitoring the sales.
What's a 4K player cost?
Double that of a Blu-ray player, probably pushing $200.
Really?
You can get a Blu-ray player for under $100 now. I think the one that I got, which was a Sony, was, maybe $189 and then tax and everything. So you're looking at about $200.
So you want to go from Blu-ray to 4K as, for your best movies, that's for sure, right?
Yeah. So what's a movie that I recently upgraded to 4K? 2001 A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's science fiction film from the late 60s. An amazing visual film. So that's one of my favorites. So I upgraded that. Blade Runner, the original Ridley Scott film with Harrison Ford, recently upgraded that. So it's going to be those real big ones are the ones that I will be upgrading. I'll tell you, though, I've already been through this. I have probably 200 or 300 DVDs that I've upgraded to Blu-ray. So when you're getting into this zone of, buying a title two, three times, that's a bit much. But sometimes it happens and you just have to, if you're a collector, you got to suffer for your craft, so to speak.
I kept some around when, the streaming was taking off. But I remember keeping some, like Lawrence of Arabia. I love James Bond, Band of Brothers, that kind of thing. The Godfather series. But I've given even those away now. So I am strictly victim to the algorithm of Netflix and streaming services now. Do you see this niche actually continuing moving forward? Like, it seems to me that if you're a real cinephile like you are, you will continue this practice.
Definitely so, but I think it will remain a small piece of the overall pie. Not everybody is going to be doing this. I think I'm somebody that is, I don't have a family. I'm a single guy, so I've got the ability to, spend some of my disposable income on this. That's, I guess, a little bit of an element of it. But going forward, there's still a lot of movies. The studios they care about the big titles, but there is such a wide array of titles of international movies and this and that. And there are these smaller labels now that are getting the rights to these movies and preserving them and doing new scans and all of that. And I think that there always will be this strong market. We've seen I don't know when it really started, but there's been a big vinyl revival. That's been a big thing in the last 15, 20 years. I know people really love the way records sound. And it's the same thing with this, these hard copies of these movies. If you want it to look the best and sound the best and you've got the home theater to do it, this is the way to do it. And it's how much is it going to grow? I think people are again, starting to realize that you can't find everything on streaming, not even close, especially if you like older movies. I guess what constitutes an older movie now, the young bucks probably think that anything prior to 2003 is an old movie now, which boggles my mind to think that Pulp Fiction is considered an old movie or something like that that still feels fresh. But
we actually have convinced ourselves that you have access to everything with the streaming services, but you actually don't. A recent survey out of the U.S. said most families in the U.S. are subscribing to four subscription channels, paying about $61 a month. So even if you did that, that's movies that you're putting towards, or money you're putting towards your DVD collection. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, I know you did an informal survey of the Chorus Radio Network here in the Vancouver area. We're good friends over at CFOX and AM730 and CFMI and NW. And I guess it was with the staff in regards to who's got actual physical copies and who doesn't.
Yeah, I did. And I got a lot of responses. I got 52 responses.
Oh, wow.
So it was one of those send it to everybody. So people out at Global and Burnaby got it. I got responses from some people out there as well. 52 responses. And what I was questioning was, what do you own in regards to physical movies? I'm sure there's people that own TV series and whatnot, but my five queries were nothing, less than 50, 50 to 100, 100 or more, or 500 plus. two people had 500 plus, myself and somebody in sales by the name of Cam. So I need to connect to Cam and see what his collection looks like, because I know each other, but not super well. 100 plus, 11 people had 100 plus titles. The core was either less than 50 or 50 to 100. There was about 30 people that would have anywhere from 0 to 100 discs, but 10 people, like you, it sounds like, were in the, I have completely removed everything and nothing. I didn't have any follow-up questions, but one thing I bet is the case with some of these people that have less than 50 or 63 movies. I didn't follow up saying, do you have a DVD player still? Do you have a Blu-ray player? Because they might have, you know, oh, I've got a box of DVDs sitting there. Do you have the ability to play them? Good friend of mine who worked in the movie business, who is retired. I play golf with him a lot. I said, oh, I've got this new disc of To Live and Die in L.A., one of my favorite crime movies from the 80s. Let me lend it to you. Oh, yeah, I love that. I saw it when it came out. I want to see that again. And I gave him the disc, and he said, wait a second. I don't have a player. And it's not streaming. You might be able to buy it on YouTube, and streaming something on something like YouTube, there's buffering. It's just not as nice as an actual hard copy disc. So that's the follow-up question that I didn't ask is, okay, you might have the discs. Do you have the ability to still play them, I guess, is the question. But, people still have them kicking around, but none of those big collections.
One of the things of having the hard copy is you're not slave to Netflix and Disney and Apple and Amazon, that you can actually watch in your own time, and you physically have paid for this. There's no other payments after that, rather than for streaming services. We had the same problem in my house that many homes have. You sit down to watch something and you go, oh, what do you want to watch? It takes you 25 minutes to find something. But if you had your own collection or kept the good ones, you can actually go back to them. So I'm glad there's still guys like you.
Well, you know what? It's nice to share art. You know, it's a lot easier. Hey, oh, you haven't seen that? Holy cow. Here you go. I'm going to lend you. You know, you haven't seen Fargo? Holy cow. Here you go. You haven't seen Goodfellas? I've got it. Let's watch it. Let's experience that. So this nice thing about art is being able to share it with people and having a physical copy. Here you go. There it is.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the Jazz Joe Hall Show live Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. on 980 CKNW and connect with me on Twitter at Jazz Joe Hall BC. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.